All right, so that was a bit of a choppy little start there on my side. I apologize for that. I want to thank everyone for coming today to this digital meeting here on Zoom, where the Rising Tide Foundation is proud to host Sean Stone, who's somebody who's a very interesting person. I don't think he needs any introduction. Everyone here in varying degrees is familiar with Sean's work. What I am most happy about is that we are going to begin a theme over the course of the coming weeks ahead, dealing with different aspects of the nature of creativity as a power to do great good, but also as a power which has been abused and perverted in order to enslave in various ways too, by creating a false illusion of what it looks like without the substance of what it actually is. This is something without a sensitivity to this, it's really impossible to not only make sense of a lot of the matters of the political, geopolitical domain that shape the world we're living in, but it's also impossible to make sense of anything in universal history. Going back hundreds, thousands of years, you can't really make sense of this if you don't get an idea of the power of the imagination, how the imagination dances with reason, and how both of these, when working together in a proper, healthy, mature human soul, expresses itself in the form of political emancipation, economic liberty, as well as greater degrees of Renaissance processes that take different forms in different parts of the world and different cultural matrices that it finds itself. But there's something universal. So what I love so much about Sean Stone, he's one of the few analysts, historians, he wears a lot of hats, who's very sensitive to this. And so Sean, today I think you wanted to have sort of a more informal process in discussing the question of the power of creativity. I know that Sean, you are, amongst your many hats, you are a poet as well. Sean's recently published a poetry book, as well as has done incredible original research on history with his book, The New World Order, which I'm halfway through reading, and has produced and directed a variety of films, both documentaries as well as fiction. So there's no one more equipped that I know of who can talk about some of these things. And so, Sean, I thought maybe we would start by just opening up the door to the question of why film? Like, what is it about this domain that you found yourself exploring that you find to be such a great power that you've devoted your attention to, your creativity to, and what do you hope to achieve? Because some of the work you do, some people say, oh, it's very dark. You know, you've gone through some very dark material in terms of the research that you have unveiled. How can this empower people to be better human beings? What is your view of that?
Absolutely. So hopefully you can hear me okay.
Sure.
I told you, as you know, we are in a weak Wi-Fi zone here at the center here in south of Portugal. And so to start out, you know, creativity is something that I believe every human being is innately endowed with. And I think that we've created cultures or societies that have in many ways esteemed creativity, you know, and in some ways rightfully, but also in many ways as we've seen across, especially 21st century America and even late 20th century America, in many ways, there was a fame mongering. There was a selling of fame. There was a fixation, a fascination, you know, on this notion of fame, and the people that are associated with, you know, creativity, oftentimes, you know, be it actors, directors, right, writers, things like this, that were very or musicians as well, obviously being very celebrated, but almost to the place where I got a chance to see it as the son of a famous filmmaker, almost to the place I feel like it became uncomfortable. And I think a lot of people have realized how uncomfortable this fixation on fame has basically distorted and warped many people's understanding of the creative arts as something that, you know, how do you say, it's basically deviated from the need to actually share something that we feel is socially, culturally relevant, right? And it's deviated and fallen into this notion of just self-expression for the sake of self-expression, right? And oftentimes what we see with modern society is very much the five-year-old impulse to act out, or the childish impulse to act out. And so when it comes to, you know, the question of why, you know, why film, I don't feel like I specifically focus only on film. I do look at film as one of the great works of art, or possible, potentially great works of art, because you have this opportunity to merge the writing process, right, of a play, right, of a spoken word writing process, with the art form of photography, cinematography, and you know, when it's done well, we recognize how beautiful it can be, how moving the visual medium is. Music is integral to storytelling, as we know. There's hardly any films you'll see that don't have a score underlying it. Occasionally a director will try something original and just not have a score and just have whatever is in the film itself. If you're listening to the radio, it'll play that, but if otherwise they won't have a score. But it's most films, as you know, are scored. So music as a component, and then the performative art of, again, of acting and and exuding, right, emoting and creating a relationship between characters, between the performers and also with the audience that's absorbing it. So to me, I look at film with tremendous awe and respect for this medium that has taken all these different crafts that are, you know, you mentioned hundreds, if not thousands of years old, and put them together. And yet film is kind of, as for many people would say, you know, it's kind of dying. I don't think that it's going to die, because I don't think that the opera is dead either. I don't think plays are dead and literature is dead. But as we know, that there has been a shift in the way people perceive the socio-cultural interaction of what we did, and throughout the 20th century, since the 30s, really, and having a moment where you would go to the theater and you had an experience, very much as we know, going back for hundreds of years, going to a play, right? Hearing the play, an audience would show up, you'd gather, you'd have a communal experience. Going back to the times of the Greeks. And so we lost, in many ways, I think, that communal experience of film. I think it was already dying by the end of the 20th century. By the beginning of the 21st century, we saw it pretty starkly with the emergence of reality television. Now reality television has sort of given way. It's a pervasive media culture, right? And which is not all bad, by the way, just to say, like, the film doesn't necessarily have the impact and meaning it once did, because with so much media that's accessible to us, we're on YouTube, we're on Instagram, we're on whatever, any number of these mediums, right, to hear someone's perspective. TikTok, right? Someone can be famous on TikTok. Someone can be famous on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Am I breaking up? Or can you?
No, it's good. It's clear. Yeah.
Yeah. And so just to say that, essentially, I look at film, to me, still as one of the great art forms in its potentiality, right? We've seen there are great films that have been made. Majority of films are probably not great films. Majority of films are done for commercial aspirations, right? Purely the bottom line. Make it for the budget that someone perceives as being the best opportunity to make money. But if we look at, again, some of the great films across the last 100 years or so, it's a tremendously powerful medium. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because it brings so many elements, as I mentioned, across the artistic spectrum together. But ultimately, it is not an end-all be-all for me or for anyone, I believe. Ultimately, we are, as I said at the beginning, we are each of us creators. And so I think, of course, this conversation will get into what that looks like and how we evolve through that process of making something. And whether it's a movie, whether it's planting a seed and creating a garden, designing something, you know, being an architect, being a painter, whatever it may be, there are so many forms of expression. Working your way through a composition, or even just working through a piano piece that you're learning. Each of these, I believe, are opportunities for us to express our creative instinct. And then again, we have to go back to the notion of what Plato talked about, as far as the notion of creativity from an ideal realm, where ideas come from, right? I've always believed that it's not just brains. I'm not a materialist in that sense, right? That when it comes to the question of consciousness, I don't see consciousness residing in the brain. I see consciousness, how do you say, imbuing all existence. And essentially this is experiencing consciousness. And so somehow the ideal forms of things come from that spiritual ideal world, you know, spiritual dimension into the physical dimension. And I believe that each of us has the power to capture that in a sense in our moments of, as we know, inspiration, of awe, of fascination, passion. So again, this dialogue will be about creativity and why it is that we as humans, that's what it is, as I say, as many people have said, what makes a human unique as a being, at least on this planet, is this power of creativity, not just driven for survival, right? I mean, you could say a beaver is creative in creating a dam or something. You could say that animals are creative. And I think that goes to a little bit of your question about the cunning and the nature of people that are clever or manipulative. And yes, you can say that they have creativity, but oftentimes they're driven by survival and fear. And the human potential for creativity is driven by love, a desire to connect, right? A desire to not just self-express, but connect with others in an emotional, psycho-emotional landscape that hopefully inspires a thought, a response, right? A dialectical, a movement, right? Essentially, ultimately, it's about a movement. It's not just, I'm creating because I'm scared, I need to survive, so I'm going to manipulate others. And this ultimately we'll get into is more that, to me, the root of what the dark side does. And it's desire for creation from, as I said before, monetary gain. Oh, I can make this product and make it cheap and sell it and sell a lot of it. And that to me is very much like an animal just trying to survive, as opposed to what the human does, which is more of drawing upon the ideal state to go beyond survival to a more ideal world.
That's beautifully said. I know that there are some people here who are script writers in the live audience as we speak. I was wondering if you put a bit more flesh on the bones regarding the idea of the two types of expressions in film that you outlined in general form. And I really love that idea of the platonic world, the realm of the ideal, the world of being that is shaping and transcending the world of becoming, the world that we live in as physical bodies. Which is eternal, which doesn't change. And what are some examples of what you think a good film that edifies and uplifts and has this quality? What are the characteristics of those? Because we see so many examples of films that do the opposite and artistic expression sure. that do the opposite. And do you have any examples of the sorts of...
It's like the films... I mean, the films that nourish us. But again, you say the ideal realm. So you think that there's a realm that doesn't change? Because I don't know that anything in the nature of the universe doesn't change, because to me, everything is if it's moving, right, there's change in it. If it's a fixed state, I don't know that how it would engage with the rest of the moving universe. You see?
Right.
So to me, everything is in some kind of evolutionary process or some state of becoming.
Right. I think I was thinking more in the terms of things like the, like I could imagine a time when my microphone didn't exist or this planet didn't exist as physical things or I didn't exist, however, as a physical being at least. But when it comes to things like concepts like, you know, a triangle or a square or a pentagon, obviously when you try to draw one, you can always make it more perfect. You can never do something so perfect that it can't be made better. But I can't think of a time or I can't think of a square, like a time before which square existed, or something that is that has that perfection in the mind. Like I could imagine a perfect square that has perfect 90 degree angles on four sides, though I can't ever draw it in the physical world. I think I was thinking more like that. Do you think that there is such a?
To me, it's interesting. I don't know that the ideal realm would be fixed. Unless, how do you say it would? It might be. How do you say? I feel like it's always aspirational, everything. I feel like that's the nature of consciousness itself, right? It's almost, it's not Hegelian, but there is a dialectical process, right? Even a Platonic process of like questioning, wanting to know the, and you say it's the, we can, it's hard to talk about the ideal realm because you can't think about it because before you, before the thought. So it's like, you know, it's like, what is the I, right? Before we only know I am, and I am what I am has to do something, right? I am being, I am whatever it is, you know, there's there, but if you go before the I, what does that look like? So again, I mean, I don't like to talk too much about the ideal realms because that's where people get into sort of metaphysics, right? And their conceptions of what heaven would be like or perfected states. And I think that, but the danger of that, of course, is that it sometimes when we try to, it's like when people say, this is what God looks like, or this is what God wants. You can get a very dangerous territory, as you know, because ultimately that can lead to theocracy, and the same with politics. It can lead to, I want to say political theocracy, but essentially social theocracy, the idea of just, this is the way you have to behave. And I feel that the a major aspect of the human experience is this, as we know, the polarity, the duality, the ability to be wrong, right? If you can't, if you're not free to fail, if you're not free to be wrong, then you're not free at all. So much of this experience of humanity is the grappling with things that are dark, that are negative, that are you know, that are trash, right? But also that's how we find, as they say, you know, how do you say it? It's like where do the pigs find the truffles, right? Like you have to sometimes weed through that. You have to go through the muck to find the pearl. So to me, it's like I don't like to judge art as harshly. Actually, I think I was probably harsher when I was at different phases when I was younger. I think now I'm more appreciative of that which I can find, which is positive. Now, granted, there are some films that are like, it's hard to find anything positive with it, right? There are some worldviews that are so nihilistic, I find personally like abhorrent as a spirit, because I can't even, how do you resonate with a worldview that basically just ends with annihilation or total destruction of all, or like a total horror film where everyone dies. I mean, just like, it's too, to me, that's too nihilistic. But beside those type of worldviews, those types of negatives, for the most part, and obviously there is always a purpose because it does inspire us, right? If we see something totally negative, we say, no, that's not my ending. I want a happier ending. I want people to resolve this conflict or overcome that villain, that dark side. So ultimately I'm saying that all art, I believe, serves a purpose. And you can even say that about the reality TV culture. It's hard to fathom, but yes, in a way you have to see the obscene extremes of materialism, right? To recognize sometimes, for those that need it, obviously I don't think everyone needs to see that, but for those that need it, to say, wait a minute, this is garbage, this is trash, this is not what I want with my life, this is not serving my soul. So it's a difficult, I guess it's a difficult point, but I'm getting at the idea that Satan is a necessary being within my cosmology to really elucidate things, to tempt, to show you the sour, the dark, the evil, and then in inversions, you know, inversions very much being sort of, okay, so this is not where we want to go. But you have to choose, you have to make your choice. So to get to your question about what I do find inspirational as stories go, I mean, I obviously I've seen so many films all my life, it's difficult to like narrow it down, but as a young man, I would have said films like I'll just go to JFK. You know, my dad's film JFK I think was very moving on many dimensions, as my friend Dennis Speed, who works with EIR, he said it's like a classical Greek tragedy, right? Because here you have someone who's crusading to solve a mystery, the murder of your president, right? Your king in the old days. And he's crusading basically against the world order, against the powers, against the fates, right? To try to discover this truth. And ultimately, does he really discover it? He discovers not fully, he discovers maybe aspects of it. He starts to unveil it, but ultimately he cannot overcome a system that is embedded itself in, you know, in our in our political structures, in our psyche, in our, you know, the media basically being a great purveyor of this lie. So JFK to me is like a wonderful example of a classically great film, right? Based on a very simple premise of a murder mystery, but with a heroic character who doesn't necessarily achieve that which he's going for, but he certainly does everything he can and striving. And thankfully, it's not a tragedy in the sense he doesn't fall, but America, as we know, in many ways, was the tragedy is about America, not about him. Garrison, the investigator, thankfully. Garrison didn't, you know, he died as an older man, thankfully. But America, in many ways, experienced the tragedy of that murder and the unresolved question of who did it. So JFK is a great film. Another film when I was a young man that really struck me. I mean, there were so many, as I said, but Thin Red Line, which is a Malick film, I found to be tremendously impactful in my psyche, because I never have really seen a film. And I mean, there are many when you study film history, but at that point, I'd never seen a film that was so poetic, that was truly poetry on screen, and the ability to basically convey war as this, how do you say, the stream of consciousness showing basically various sides, but not really, never vilifying the enemy, which I think was really important, right? Mm-hmm. Because too many times in war films, it's like there's a vilification. There's a, yeah, you know, let's go get those guys, right? Let's go kill them, get those, whatever, Germans and, you know, Viet Cong, whatever it was. Like, there was always this glorification, you know, the ragheads, like all these there. But Thin Red Line, I think, was a powerful film in that it wasn't about, it was really more a Christ character, which I guess you could say most of the great stories come from the Bible. You could find probably the source of many of these classic films in the Bible, but the Christ figure who essentially is too pure for this world. There's a beautiful dialogue going out throughout that film, talking about the ideal realm, by the way, where the Sean Penn character is a realist and fundamentally just can't believe that there's a greater world beyond this one, right? It's just, this is it. This is the rock. This is where you live and die on this rock. And the Caviezel character, and he went on to play Jesus in another film, ironically. Well, not ironically, I think very fittingly. He was basically the Christ figure in Thin Red Line. And he was saying, no, there's something else out there. You know, I've seen it. I've touched, I've sensed it. I've connected with it, right? It's a more pure reality, a way of engaging as brothers and sisters without this need for conflict, this need for controlling.
Uh-oh. As Sean warned us, his internet is a little bit choppy. Let's hope this kicks back into gear. Hold on, I'm just going to send him a personal message. Okay, so Portugal doesn't seem to be renowned for having great internet. Let me try one more
Hey,
thing.
Matthew?
Yes, Pascal?
Yep, I was I did put a question in the queue. I was just I was wondering if people wanted to participate in a sense to this the idea of what kind of art do they use in their creative process. So I know as you said, there are people that are writing, that are composing in the audience. So I was wondering, I wanted to ask Sean for sure.
Well, Sean is coming back on now. So,
He started to answer these questions already, but if people wanted to partake into this, and I know that the Rising Tide has a movie list that you put together, so if people want to contribute, and maybe there are some pearls that we don't know of.
possibly. Yeah, I'll make that available. Sean has just been brought back into the game here. And he's back in on Sean, you're on mute.
Let's see if we can, yeah, let's see if we can get a little more out of this.
All right. Okay, I'm glad
So
you were able
where did
to
I lose you?
the point of the creative process. Just trying to think here. I was what was the last thing that you were saying? No, I don't actually remember the
Did you get
exact.
my was it we were talking about the dialectic and Thin Red Line? Did you get
That's
that?
right. Yeah. We got the dialectic. We got the thin red line, and the counterpoint between Sean Penn's character, who is the absolute realist, versus the more messiah-like character who believes in the hereafter and the realm beyond the mortal domain. And then you tapered off.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes, that was it. Well, that was the point, right? And then that was a beautiful dialogue running through that film. But there were many poetic themes and ideas that were conveyed against this backdrop of war, which is fundamentally one of the worst things that humans can do to each other. So I love that, it would be like it would be in the middle of a battle, and it would focus on a bird that had been shot, and basically was dying, while a soldier is trying to save his life. Or, the whole point is that nature has its wars, but they're not nearly as bloody as what we persecute against each other. Anyway, it's a powerful film. It's really worth watching and rewatching and feeling it.
Well, definitely the idea of the concept that darkness can induce or awaken light by bringing a sense of the ugliness, the horror that would cause the soul, the sensitive soul, to be so repulsed by the consequences of folly, or I mean, the folly that leads to wars, unnecessary death and destruction. That's certainly an important concept. Obviously, I think for me, the problem is one of wisdom, because I mean, you could always have two people who encounter two crises where one person has the wisdom to learn from the crises and become a better person, while the other person might just be overwhelmed or beaten down. By it, more weakened spiritually by the same type of experience. And the thing that would differentiate one from the other is this question of the activation of wisdom, to learn from mistakes, to learn from horror, so that you don't want to repeat it. How, if art can, I mean, art can obviously induce both effects in terms of an audience, depending upon the where they're at. How is it that we can ensure, or how do we get out of that paradox, right? That a lot of the art is produced by forces or interests today, at least, that want to weaken the power of the soul of the people. And of course, like I said, people who are in touch with their humanity are able to become stronger by seeing ugliness, but not everybody is in that situation. In fact, I'd say the majority of the people out there are not. So how could we enhance that ability for the people to become the best out of dark experiences presented them to them in film or in arts and other things?
I mean, it's the way of the world, right? I mean, you could say that there's more, at this point, more unconsciousness than there is consciousness, right? But even within ourselves, our unconscious is very powerful. We have to acknowledge how much we are oftentimes ruled by the unconscious mind, or but also sometimes inspired by the unconscious. So it's very difficult to say like specifically how I would address it, because to me, this is very much a psycho-spiritual war, what's taking place. And I believe that all we can do as creators is give our best, you know, to basically, how do you say, it's like, you know, you go out there and you plant your garden, and even if the land is being ravaged, I mean, you can't stop those forces, but you can counter them by offering things of beauty, or, you know, essentially truth is beauty. Beauty is truth, as Keats put it, right? Or at least your search for truth and your search for beauty, if you offer it, I believe, then trust the process of letting people find it, letting them spread the word. Because, yeah, I mean, we understand that there's a system that's been at work for a long time to manipulate the psyche of people. But I believe that thanks to things, it's like, how do you say, the evolution of technologies always works both ways, as we know. So at one level, the internet has changed the psyche and the consciousness of ourselves and the younger generations tremendously. I can't imagine being a kid growing up with all the smart devices and apps and all this. It's like so much information overload. So, you know, what do you do with that? Well, you can trust that, and you can work to basically create content that hopefully enlivens and reminds people of, hey, pick up a book, you know, learn things. You can communicate information and ideas that hopefully will inspire the youth and each other, obviously, along the way. But we can't put the genie back in the bottle, right? We can't say, well, there's no more internet, because in many ways it's helped to further the evolution of our learning. And many people have learned and come up with all kinds of ideas and information thanks to these platforms, right? So I don't know. It's not so much conflicting with those forces as it is just each of us doing our best to enlighten ourselves and share that light, I would say, you know, that wisdom that we are here with. And I believe that it's, thankfully, we're souls that are on a much longer journey and longer trajectory than this lifetime. So that always gives me comfort that it's like, there's that great quote, you know, why do you plant a tree that you're never going to sit in its shade? Well, then you're missing the whole experience of planting the tree, but also the vision and trusting the vision. And then also, I believe, you know, reincarnation, I believe that our souls are not, whether they, you know, whether it's transmigration or however that this works, our souls, we know, are not fixed and ending when we die in this realm, just as they did. This is, our souls weren't born when we were, you know, I don't know, inseminated in a womb. It was like, no, we are here for a much longer trajectory of time, so we can trust that there's a process that's at work. And yes, sometimes times get really dark, but it will never stay that way forever. The dark ages gave way to the Renaissance, and I trust that we are on course for a new Renaissance.
Absolutely. I think that's a very strong, powerful way of thinking about that, that process. Because I mean, I think that one thing that I've encountered, and I'd like to open up for questions pretty soon too, but is that the more you try to sleep, the less sleep comes to you. It requires sort of shifting the mindset. And the more you pursue finding love, the less, if you go out to try to find love, it often doesn't work. It's usually when you're pursuing something else that you will find love. And I think creativity is in some way the same thing too. And a lot of creative blocks that I've been in, it's when I'm like searching for creativity, I'm searching for the thing. And it's only when I give myself over to loving an idea that the creative muse sort of hits. So I think in that sense too, when you try to change the world or you're trying to force the good onto the world, you get more frustrated. It, right. it is more fleeting. Whereas when you learn to just live in the appreciation of beauty in its pure sense, as much as possible, you find that there are things that change in the world around you as a consequence, but it won't necessarily be because you're trying to force that good change. Pascal, had a question.
Right. Well, you should.
Pardon me?
Sure.
Yeah, Pascal had a question.
I was just saying you shift the perspective.
You know,
when you shift the perspective, just to talk to your point about the writer's block, I think the key is, as you said, being interested, right? If you're interested by something, you get excited, you pursue it, the creativity follows, right? You want to figure it out. You want to explore it. It's kind of like dating, right? It's like, oh, there's an attractive person. Let me, I'm excited to learn more, right? Mm-hmm. To explore more, to find out more, to spend more time. And that's why I agree with you. Like, if you're focused on, well, I'm not creating, so I need to go create, then you're probably not going to be inspired unless you find that which you want to create. You have to see it, and all of a sudden you say, oh, that's a great idea. That's a great whatever world that I want to go play in.
Mm-hmm. Magdalena, did you want to ask a question?
Yeah, I was thinking about, I'm a teacher, and it's young kids I'm teaching. And I always think about them obviously. And I was wondering, because I see this culture nowadays where the kids constantly discuss movies or discussing YouTube videos or discussing all kinds of things. And they're discussing good and evil and so forth. And I'm wondering, can you actually learn? What's your opinion? Do you think we can learn empathy from watching movies? Or
I think it's an aspect of art in general. Yeah. Well, to me, it's learning, like, I don't know if you can, hey, put it.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, you know, empathy is such a hard thing for a child, right? And even for young adults, we're so quickly to judge, or people used to be. They're always saying nowadays, oh, no judging. But I think really the judging is still going on. And I'm wondering what the empathy aspect of that, can that be learned through watching movies, or is it an adequate substitute to personal experience?
I'll put it like this. To me, everything is experience, because I see everything as consciousness. So even if I'm reading a book, I'm experiencing that book. No one's going to experience that book the way I experience that book. No one's going to focus on the words the way that I'm going to focus, or hear the words the way that I hear the words, right? So to me, everything is personal experience through the lens of my own consciousness. I can never know fully what's in anyone else's consciousness. That's why empathy is so important. I don't know that you can teach empathy in a sense that people that are literally like lacking empathy, like a sociopath, for example, I don't know if they can be taught empathy. But I think that anyone who has some level of empathy can work with that. And so to me, film, it just like, you know, again, there are different, there's different things there. There's YouTube videos, there's film, there's other things. People, as we know, children oftentimes imitate. So I don't agree that children don't have empathy. I think children naturally have empathy. If you're with a child and you say, oh, that hurt me. A child oftentimes will what? They'll want to go and like make it better, right? And give it a kiss or like give you a hug or something. They have natural empathy. They don't want to hurt people. But as we know, children are very much impression. They're very impressionable. Every child is traumatized at some, you know, whether it's physical, whether it's verbal, you know, obviously there's worse, but there's the trauma that kids go through is where they lose empathy, right? Because then it becomes that psychology we were talking about before, which is the survival, the reptilian brain. You know, it's, I have to win, you have to lose so I can win, right? That's basically what we're that's what kids are learning in the society. So it's not, so the films, the TV shows, I mean, there's both. There's TV shows and films where, you know, people are like mean to each other and cruel and they have no empathy. And then the kid's probably going to learn, you know, if that's their favorite show, they might learn that behavior. But they could also learn that behavior from a bully, from a father who's a bully, from a parent, whatever, a parent, a teacher, all these, there's so many different people that influence children. So I think that it's important to be aware. I mean, I'm not a parent, but I would just say parents should be aware of what their kids are watching and certainly, you know, want to inspire them with stories that show the best qualities of human behavior. I would say that's definitely an ideal. Obviously, no, it's not going to be perfect because you're not monitoring kids 24/7, but as an ideal, you want to basically show children the best qualities of humanity, and films can play a part in that if they're, you know, if they're good quality films.
Mm-hmm. It sort of touches a little bit, I find, on the question of what arose in Plato's Meno dialogue regarding can virtue be taught as well, where in the course of the dialogue, there's no real direct answer to the question, can virtue be taught? But there are displays of virtuous action in the sense of the graciousness and charity, not even charity, that's not the right word, but the joy in making a discovery that is part of the process of that slave boy, the slave of Meno, doubling the square and making a discovery. So there's the example, which I guess children, knowing that they mirror things a lot and they're looking to model what is the right way to be as I'm trying to figure things out, the role of art should be finding ways to, yeah, give them those right, the best possible models through example, instead of just didactically telling them, you know, what should be the right way you behave or other.
Very much. That's my perspective, at least. The best, as we know, I say most people would argue, we learn more through example, right? Mm-hmm. And inspiration than through sticks. I mean, we can obviously, sticks can work, but oftentimes it's not bringing out the best in people because they're oftentimes doing it begrudgingly, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like we oftentimes want to create a world where we're giving children examples and ideals. And again, this is why I believe film and all art can inspire the best aspects, the best qualities of humanity, right? Because we see it in those stories.
I think we have time probably for two more questions. Pascal and Monty have been waiting. Pascal, you've been waiting for a long time. Would you like to throw your thought out?
All right. Yeah, sure. I was wondering, we've been discussing movies since the beginning of today's talk. I was wondering about great pieces of art that might inspire your creative process. So in terms of music and paintings, you know, sometimes we look at different pieces of art in museum or other places, and it inspires to us, you know, vivid, you know, great emotions. Or sometimes it inspires us music when you're looking at a painting and you have like some kind of a music that or some kind of poetry that comes to you, and inversely when you listen to music. Is there something that you use for your creative process, or is there something that, you know, great pieces of arts that have inspired you in the past?
Well, many, many, many. It's so in my creative process, what I tend to do is immerse myself. So if I'm, let's say, writing a script, I will want to read up on, you know, whether it's the time period or the, you name it, the socio-political, cultural, whatever it may be that like really seems to resonate with the story. It can be also like watching again, like as we know, like similar movies. But when I'm writing, I very much tune into to music that feels complementary to the story, to the type of story that I'm working on. So I think this is just, I think this is what most artists would probably have similar methods, right? Of immersing themselves, of being inspired, of looking to similar art, listening to music that inspires that reality to come forth. So it's not like a one set piece that I would say, like, I always draw upon. It's not like I always listen to this music when I write, or I guess Spielberg, I'm told he watches Lawrence of Arabia before every film that he goes to make, but that's probably just more of a getting the courage up to go and do something as momentous and monumental as spending a few hundred million dollars making a movie. It takes a lot of guts.
Monty, did you want to ask a question?
Yes, Sean. Greetings from Baja, California. I was just impressed in a past presentation that Matthew did Percy Blythe Shelley on the defense of poetry. And one record I recalled or statement he made with poets were the unacknowledged legislators of the world. And that's always impressed me very deeply. And a little background to how deeply that impressed me. I was in Vietnam in 1968, 69, in a foxhole overlooking the Ashaw Valley. I had two small books with me at the time, which in trying to come to terms with the cognitive dissonance to what I was seeing in that war at the time, and my struggle to try to find something to resonate with, the two books I had was The Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam and a small book of the Bible, the Old Testament, in particular, chapter of Job, and Where Wast Thou When I Laid the Foundations of the Earth. And for myself, it inspired me to originate a poem which I wrote at that time, which basically guided my whole life experience since then, insofar as allowing me to struggle with something, and so far as beauty and truth and reconciling something. So I really believe Percy Blythe Shelley's words that poets are the legislators of freedom. In a very concise way, they can convey an idea that grips you so profoundly that it lives with you forever. So that's the thoughts that came to my mind. And I wonder if you had a comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly like to think so. I mean, now, who knows in the modern world? But we know, you can recognize that we've seen throughout history the role that artists have played. At the same time, are they the legislators of the world, or, you know, I think they're more of the collective consciousness, if you want to draw upon that concept, that there's a collective conscious, there's also probably a collective unconscious, which it makes sense that essentially the poet is drawing upon. That's what makes them known, because obviously many poets, many artists, many great, talents are not known, right? They're not remembered by history or famous, let's say, recognized in their time. So to be able to be recognized by millions of people, right, to be remembered, already indicates that you're tuning into something that that transcends your personal thought or your personal experience, right? You're tuning into the greater moment. And it's a fascinating concept to know, to say, like, what is a poet then? Because frankly, maybe we're limiting ourselves by thinking it's only the artists that are doing the artistic work, when in fact there are many people that are, as I said before, that are doing their contribution, their life art, their creatives in their own way, right? Whatever work they're doing. And I think maybe that's what he's also meaning at a broader level, is that you don't have to be a poet or an artist to be an artist, you see? Because if you can bring your particular stamp, I mean, FDR brought his stamp as a speaker, right? He was able to, even though he was, he was handicapped, and but he drew upon his ability to convey ideas, right, and thoughts in many ways. He was a poet. I don't know if he didn't probably write all the speeches, obviously there was help, but the point is that it was poetic how he's able to convey things. Churchill as well, right? These are important moments that are not done by poets, but what the point is, there's a poetry to what they're conveying that taps into what's needed at that time and space, right, in our history. So I think going beyond what Shelley's saying about poets, maybe he's also meaning that essentially it's the poetry that the great leaders, thinkers, right, artists, personalities, right, the great personalities of history, they're able to convey something that you can call their personal stamp. And that's what creativity is all about. It's bringing your personal signature to something that's much greater than you.
Yeah, I think that's an important concept. And when one looks at the essay by Shelley, it becomes clear that his idea of poetry is just as you said it is. It's not just the typical idea of the poet who does rhyme and meter in the written word, but rather anything that is imbued with that creative spark, which leaps outside of its own limits to go into the unknown with love, and then translate that in any way, in any form. And he brings up, with that definition, as you said, Martin Luther King, Franklin Roosevelt would be very much qualified as poets in that sense, because they didn't just stick with a lower potential. They were able to train their mind to see the potential rather than just make judgments based upon where things were in the moment. And that potential is only something you can access through the imagination, through the mind. And because it doesn't exist yet in that sense, right? So what do we have to access that which doesn't exist is the imagination. And whether that imagination can be shaped by understanding and love or the opposite will determine to what degree poetry is or its absence is shaping what one might call art. Because sometimes art might, because that's I guess part of the problem that I'm struggling with a little bit is the fact that art can sometimes undermine one's potential powers of creativity and love. Right. Sometimes there are forms of art that do that. And then there's other types that enhance and broaden our access to those universal sentiments. And so one could blame art or one could blame poetry for the reduction of that human goodness. But that would be wrong. And in Shelley's thesis, it would be the degree to which that art departed from that motive force of love and understanding would be the degree to which destruction was carried in its wake and not the opposite. I don't know what you think of that.
Remember the destruction is also part of the creative process. It's and unfortunately it happens at the individual level and it happens at the global level. And it's not always bad. I mean, obviously, I think that there's extremes, right? We see that, but you can have a controlled burn before replanting, right? So there is a necessary quality of destruction. It's when the forces get out of hand, and you could say, well, out of hand. But then there is the power of the tsunami, the power of the volcano. I mean, these things are forces too of nature that are not prevalent, right? They don't happen every year all the time, but they do occur. So again, it's not so much that I'm arguing for bad art. I'm simply saying that it wouldn't hook in. Okay, let's put it like this. They say life, does life imitate art or does art imitate life? But to me, it's this sort of reciprocal notion, right, of consciousness. Like, how can the bad art hook in if there wasn't something to hook into in our consciousness that was wanting this, right, collectively? And so many times have been critical. The beginning of the 21st century, I was very critical of the nature of like the films that were being created, especially. I was like, wow, they're not trying to elevate the population anymore. They're just kind of, they feel like and you've had fun stuff like comic book movies, right? They're designed for children, right? Or for grown-ups who've never really evolved past pubescence, right? Or like, but I think that's a little bit too harsh, because there's a time and space for it. And then I believe that evolution demands that people eventually get bored of that. And I think that's kind of where we are now. It's like people kind of getting bored of, okay, we're another Marvel movie, really, like another remake. Like, can we create something new? That's what I feel the impulse is moving towards, is like maybe a return to more of the classical films, you know, the 30s, 40s, 50s, whatever. Like, there was a little bit more innocence, maybe, to some of the quality of storytelling. It wasn't as in your face and overt. It was a little bit more subtle, but a lot of the themes were more mature, ironically, right? And I think we could be moving in that direction in this coming decades.
I hope so. Well, definitely mediocrity cannot be pushed. You can't push that forever. At a certain point, the lukewarmness of everything is it just stagnates. So I think you're right. I think that there is a hunger now for some substance that we haven't seen before. And I think that will increase. I know we're rounding out the end of the hour. Do you have time for one last question or no?
Yeah. I think I see a couple of questions. So
you have time for two last questions? Okay. All right. Well,
Let's do that.
Let's do Satomi and Jerry. Satomi, go for it.
Oh, thank you. Well, just everything that you're saying, Sean, like, I'm wondering, like, I've been thinking a lot of individual sovereignty is really the basis for all creativity, like authentic, of course, authentic creativity. And, you know, Catherine Austin Fitz said something really interesting about when she was asked about China and Russia, like, she called them like nations, sovereign nations, but they lack individual sovereignty. And you know, like, I think this is why maybe the Constitution like models where individual sovereignty is paramount, which I don't know. What do you think? I feel that she made a really important point about that individual sovereignty. National sovereignty is important, but it has to be based on individual sovereignty.
Well, that's something that is it's a felt thing, as you know. I mean, China and Russia both have tremendous artists, so again, obviously, there is individual sovereignty there, but culturally, as we know, there's problems, right, around autocracy and you know, the forms of government perhaps, you know, not being as democratic as we'd like. So as far as the you're asking how the individual sovereignty plays into the artistic process, right, into the ability to create.
Of course, that is, I think, for authentic creativity, it's important. You have to have that individual's, you know, be able to be an individual and voice that and express that. But maybe this is why America has always been able to surmount and overcome so much, because I think the basis of the Constitution has always been the individual self-government, you know, beginning with the individual.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm certainly a huge advocate of that principle, as we see now what happens when you get, well, ironically, it's like the liberal cult that wants to strip people of their individual sovereignty when it comes to like body rights and whatnot. It's very funny. Or even the liberals that are pushing for more censorship, I've seen. It's all backwards in America. But individual sovereignty is the basis of the ability to create. Because if you're being told what to do, if you're being forced, what option do you have? I mean, essentially the human spirit at some point has to break through that shell. And so I see history very much as we are reaching the end of totalitarianism in many ways. Like this time period feels like the end of thousands of years of totalitarianism. And how we're getting there is by, in many ways, by the polarization of this time period, because through the polarization, that's how we start to, I say, we start to recognize alternatives. We start to stand for things that we didn't really realize we had to stand for. I mean, especially in America and the West, it's like having to stand for freedom. It was like, really? That seems strange, but here we are. Yes, individual sovereignty has to be the basis for the ability to create. Otherwise, it's not creation, it's just repetition. And that's, to me, the most dangerous aspect of what's being pushed as a narrative in the West, is this notion that we can censor you. If you say something that we deem to be wrong, you can be banned or censored or exiled. Like this would be the end of Western civilization if that idea prevails. And to me, that idea is a machine like roboticization of humanity, because the human spirit doesn't want to be told what to do. And we've seen that throughout time. Every empire falls because ultimately the human spirit says no, and it rejects the compulsion at a certain point. There's a certain place where we say enough. I'm not going to be forced to do this against my will.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Because I know, like, I would never be speaking up like this if it wasn't for this kind of awakening, this movement that's been happening.
Well, Ben Franklin, I think, knew what he was talking about when he made the point that anybody who is dumb enough to give up their liberties to capture some security, it deserves neither. And he was probably one of the most sovereign human beings in the last few hundred years, who created the foundations not only of a new science through his discoveries of electricity and this electric fire from the sky that confounded and scared so many people, but that was the flip side of the same discovery in his mind of what he did by organizing the basis upon which a new type of government could exist that could actualize so many of these potentials that were latent and not able to be expressed under systems of hereditary rule of might makes right that had dominated pretty much all of human history. So that's, I think, a very important idea for artists, for sure. Jerry, do you want to throw in the last question?
Yes. Can you hear me? You good? Yes.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sean. This has been very enlightening, interesting. I just wanted to ask you a question about the idea of myths. You know, kind of to pick your brain, because you've, you know, had certain experience in creative work and that. And it's something I've been thinking about, particularly since Cynthia did her classes on C.S. Lewis. And kind of touching on Tolkien too. And I think we were talking about King Arthur, but the idea that there's different kinds of myths or different ways you can use myth. And like in my thinking, I'm thinking, well, okay, there's one way, I call it fantasy, where you just create this thing, but it kind of just spins out there and can go on forever. And there's another, I don't know how to call it, another use of myth where you're really using the myth to get at development of an underlying idea. And I've been kind of struggling with this. And I just wondered if you've been thinking about this idea of myth and how it can be used in creative work. I'd like to pick your brain on that, Sean.
Well, I like what Cocteau said about myths. He said, I always prefer myths to history because history starts out true and ends up as a myth. And myths start off as fiction and end up as truth. So there's myths to me are fascinating because I actually tend to think they're not based in fiction. They're based more in large concepts, right? Be it some kind of astrological truth could be of a different dimension, you know, I say of that ideal realm we were talking about before, right? The Bible is full of myths. What's real in the Bible? Who knows? But there's something about the nature of humanity and the nature of reality that's being told through the mythology, right? So when it comes to myth, I don't know. I'm very much fascinated by myths. I'm also feeling that we are at a place where we have been playing out in many ways in our lifetimes old myths. And I'm very curious to know what new myths can be spawned and created here to basically shift the course of humanity, because again, we've been playing out so many of these falls, you know, the myths of the fall of humanity, essentially. Or did I lose you?
No, you're there.
Okay. This journey, I would just say this journey through the dark night of the soul, and it's like, and you know, basically coming back, the hero's return, but we never really see what happens. Okay, what happens next? What does the ideal realm look like? Right? Can we actually reimagine a more ideal version of Earth? Because so much of the mythology, as we know, is predicated in villainy, excess, you know, greed, lust, things like this, right? A lot of the sins, and ultimately like overcoming the dark forces. But there's very little about living after you've overcome the dark forces.
Hmm.
So I wonder if the future maybe needs more mythology about what, how do you say, we need to plant the seeds of mythologies about the golden age, basically, right? What does the golden age look like and feel like? Maybe those are the myths that we need now.
I guess the challenge there is always that there's something about the creative process that involves tension and overcoming, you know, and when you have a story which is just based upon painting a picture of a just world, a beautiful world by itself, it doesn't really capture the creativity, or it feels maybe a bit didactic or stale, and people don't really believe in it. But it's only when you could see that, like, that's why I like the movie The Martian, you know, with Matt Damon from 2015. What I liked about it is that it had that Robinson Crusoe quality, where instead of it being human beings in the future in space getting killed by aliens or dying in the abyss, which is usually sort of the type of theme you tend to see amplified, this was a problem solver having to make creative discoveries in order to stay alive, come back to Earth, and become a teacher, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And I think the idea of showcasing, because people lack a sense of what a normal, healthy world could be, and because they lack that standard in their soul, they don't have an ability to judge where are we moving away from that. What are, you know, are we making decisions in our lives that are taking us down an unnatural path? Normally, I think people would be able to see, okay, we're doing something wrong. Let's self-correct. But without that sense in the heart, there's nothing really to contrast the wrong towards. There's no good to use as light and darkness. So yeah, I like that idea of being able to showcase myths and stories that are able to both have tension, but also showcase the good in various ways of what's possible. I think that's an important idea. And to make it engaging.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the hard part. Like I said, that's why the devil is such a compelling character in the narrative, because it's like, well, without the polarity, without the dark side, well, what is there to resist, to create the resistance, the friction for movement? it's a challenge, isn't it?
Well, the power in the Bible, in the biblical stories too, of even Jesus, you know, the two most, I think, moving, compelling components of that drama was the period of temptation in the desert, and also the time when he has a choice to give into the more animalistic feeling, because, you know, the devil pretty much says anything you want. You can rule over anything you want in the material realm. It's all yours. And there's a certain fight within himself to choose something higher and more more durable as a passion. And the other thing, when he's on the cross and he has a chance to give in to hate, fear, anger at being unjustly tortured and killed, but he chooses instead to forgive and to ask God yes. to forgive the people because they know not what they do. And though it's so yes. dark, it really makes the story, gives it its substance in a more heavy way.
That's why Last Temptation of Christ is a great, great book and film. I haven't read the book, but the film is wonderful because it goes into exactly those temptations. Hmm. Yeah.
Well, Sean, this has been a very edifying, this is exactly what I wanted. This is a really great presentation, a really wonderful way to spend a Sunday. And I think you've set the stage for the coming presentations that we're going to see in the weeks ahead. You know, next week we have Dr. Michael Claridge, who's going to go into something on Dr. Luc Montagnier's discoveries and the question of light and life and what's been kept from mainstream science. So that's going to be a fun presentation, followed by some stuff on Edgar Allan Poe. And I think Ray McGovern is going to do something in 2 weeks. So it's going to be fun. Sean, thank you so much for spreading your, or sharing, I should spread, for sharing your wisdom and your experience. Do you have any parting words for people who would like to know more about your work? And
no, I hope everyone who joined, and thank you all for being here.
Okay. And I'm going to make sure that your website and all of your work, your books and your videos are contained in the description box of this video. Thank you, everyone. And hope to see everyone next Sunday. Cheers.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Ciao.
Thank you.